Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher and Wellness Wednesday. Ear infections are one of the most common reasons kids end up in the doctor's office, and most kids leave the doctor's office with a prescription for antibiotics in those cases. But antibiotics have their downside. They can cause upset stomachs and allergic reactions, and overusing them can have a negative health effect on later in life. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently issued new guidelines on how to treat ear infections. Here to talk about these new guidelines is one of the authors, Dr. Richard Rosenfeld. He's a professor and chairman of otolaryngology at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rosenfeld.
Thank you for having me.
So the new guidelines warn against prophylactic use of antibiotics. That means that doctors have been prescribing them even if there's not necessarily an infection or before an infection occurs. What is that about?
That would have two meanings. The first, prophylactic antibiotics have been used in the past primarily for kids who are frequent flyers. They get lots of ear infections. They're really good at it. And one of the ways to try and reduce it is to put the child on a daily low dose of an antibiotic, perhaps half the normal daily dose, and you continue that for 3 months or 6 months. It does very slightly reduce the number of ear infections, but it's a minimal decrease, and it's not recommended because of all the resistant bacteria you get while the kids are on those prolonged antibiotics. So prophylactic antibiotics would not be recommended for that purpose. It's just not worth it. And the second thing that might fit what you're describing is where you're kind of not sure if the child has an ear infection, or maybe it's an early ear infection, and you say, well, gee, let's prevent it by giving some antibiotic before it gets out of hand. That's also a very bad practice because, number one, it doesn't work, and number two, there's no studies to show any basis for it.
My guest is Dr. Richard Rosenfeld. He's a professor and chairman of otolaryngology at the State University of New York. We're talking about a new set of guidelines on how to treat ear infections. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Rosenfeld, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So we've all heard about, or, you know, have been there when something or another burst in the inner ear of their child. What are the warning signs of a serious problem? What should we be looking for?
So you're absolutely right that by the time they hit school age, pretty much every child, with rare exception, is going to have at least one ear infection. The ones we need to be concerned about are the more severe ones, because they typically need antibiotics, and if they're not treated, it can spread to other parts of the child's head, including the bone by the ear or even the brain. So we need to be attentive to those serious ones. The things to look out for are these. First, if the eardrum is actually popped and there's pus or blood coming out of the ear, that's something that should be seen by a doctor, and generally that would require an antibiotic. The other types of ear infections that benefit from antibiotics are the severe ones, and those are children who have an ear infection and they have either a high fever, so it's more than 102.2, or they've been complaining about very substantial or severe pain in the ear, especially if it's been going on for a couple of days without relief. So those two categories would get the most benefit from antibiotic. And on the flip side, there's a category of children with less severe infections that are fine to just watch and wait.
So when we talk about, I think at the top of the hour, I said something about letting your kids stay up all night screaming in pain. And they can be very painful, even when they're not very serious. What are some of the ways that parents can help their children with the pain, help them get through it without resorting to an antibiotic, which may or may not help anyway?
Well, that's a great question. And it's a great question because even with antibiotics, it takes at least 24 hours before it has any effect on how the kids feel. So a lot of parents will push for the antibiotic or ask for the antibiotic with the hope that, boy, I'll get this into my child before bedtime. They'll sleep better. I'll go to work the next day. They'll go to daycare. It doesn't work like that. So that's a complete wrong expectation. If you want kids with ear infections to feel better with or without antibiotics, the key is adequate pain relief. And typically that would be ibuprofen given before bedtime. Acetaminophen is fine too, but doesn't last quite as long. It's not as effective. So a healthy dose of ibuprofen before bedtime and continue that over the first 24 hours. That could even be alternated with acetaminophen if you need extra relief. There are also some pain-relieving eardrops that you can get in a lot of the stores. They could be the prescription drops or naturopathic drops. They have some mild effect, but they should not be the sole thing to relieve pain because it's a very quick and temporary effect with the drops.
For some kids, it's harder when they're laying down, isn't it? There's more pressure?
If you're laying flat, you can get a buildup of pressure. So mm-hmm. some children will find it better to be propped up maybe 10, 20 degrees in bed to relieve a little pressure.
The new guidelines also recommend ways that parents can protect kids from ear infections. How do you do that?
Well, there's a couple different things that we know are effective from good research. One of the best is exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months. That's probably a little late to start this if your child's 9 months old and has ear infections, but it might work the next time around. Mm-hmm. But the key thing here is that it really does need to be exclusive. So meaning you can't just give some breast milk and then supplement with a bottle or other food stuff. You got to be real serious about this. If it's at least 4 months of exclusive breastfeeding, preferably six, and you'll really reduce the frequency of ear infections, of frequent ear infections, and even upper respiratory infections in children. The other way, Ann, is to avoid the secondhand smoke. Mm. Being around tobacco smokers is very bad for kids' ears. It affects their upper respiratory tract. So they certainly shouldn't be in the car when parents are smoking or in close proximity to someone smoking would be a good preventive. Other things include immunizations, which are now pretty routine. There's the Prevnar vaccine, which is the conjugate pneumococcal vaccine. That's part of the regular immunization schedules of all kids in the U.S. since the year 2000. It's given at 2, 4, 6, and then again at 12 to 14 months. That does reduce pneumococcus, one of the big bad germs that cause ear infections, and has a reduction, so get your regular shots. And then the influenza vaccine, which is recommended in most children, does reduce by about 30% the frequency of ear infections in the winter flu season. So there are a number of good things that parents can do to reduce the impact on their kids.
Once again, my guest is Dr. Richard Rosenfeld, professor and chairman of otolaryngology at the State University of New York and Downstate Medical Center. He is one of the authors of a new set of guidelines on how to treat ear infections. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Why, in what way does breastfeeding for 4 to 6 months exclusively improve your outcomes when it comes to ear infections? How does that work?
Well, you're basically transferring the immunity from the mother to the child. I mean, breast milk is full of antibodies. It helps fight infection. It's very easily absorbed. So it's a great way to boost the child's immune system. When the children are born, their immune system is actually pretty good because it's all through the transfer through the placenta from the mother. But then over those first 6 months of life, it begins to really go down as the baby sort of uses up everything they've received from the mother. And by 6 to 9 months, it's pretty low, and that's when they start getting their ear infections and colds. So the breast milk actually helps supplement the immune system and really provide some protection, even though the baby's acquired protection from the mother at birth is dwindling.
What are more kids getting ear infections? I don't remember it being such a big deal when I was a kid, which was a long time ago, but not a big deal at all. And even growing up, I just don't remember it. Is there a reason for that, or am I imagining it?
Well, it's the number one reason that children in the U.S. are going to receive an antibiotic. So it's big-time stuff. Some would call it an occupational hazard of early childhood. It's that common. And so it's common, but certainly not everybody gets it. About 10 to 15% of children will become frequent flyers, getting many, many repeated or recurrent ear infections. It's actually come down a little over the years, and the primary reason has been some of the vaccination practices, so that Prevnar vaccine that's given to kids seems to have had an impact on the frequency of ear infections and repeated ear infections and ear tubes. I think people are just more attentive now to the problem. It's diagnosed better. And a lot of people are more comfortable with watching and waiting, so some of it probably doesn't even make it to the doctor to get diagnosed.
I heard a report on NPR that included an interview with a doctor who said that getting kids better faster with antibiotics can make a difference for parents who are working outside the home, and that that has driven up the pressure to use antibiotics more. And I'm wondering, don't doctors know better than to have that be what drives them when it comes to prescribing something?
Well, I think they do. But honestly, it takes much more time not to prescribe an antibiotic in your daily office practice than it does to prescribe it, mm-hmm. because you have to give a lot more explanation. And that's really what these guidelines are aimed at. They're aimed at facilitating a real shared decision-making process between the parent, the caregiver, and the doctor. And that begins with the diagnosis. It's perfectly fine as a parent to say to the doctor when they tell you your child has an ear infection, three words. Are you sure? Now, that may catch the doctor off guard, but unless they're really sure, you shouldn't be giving an antibiotic. And it's not so easy to be sure. You have to get a good look at that eardrum. It should be bulging. Sometimes it's hard to see the eardrum. And the second opportunity for the shared decision is really deciding whether or not to use the antibiotic. I know, Anne, a while ago you asked about who should get the antibiotics, who are the sick kids. If it's all right with you, I think it's important to say a few words about who you can safely watch and wait on. Is that okay?
Yes, please.
So the best kids to sort of hold off and let them fight the infection on their own would be children who are 6 months or older, and they have an ear infection in just one side, one ear. And they're not terribly ill, meaning they don't have a high fever above 102. They're not in severe pain. It hasn't been going on for many, many days. So they have a new onset of an ear infection in one ear, and it's not too bad. These children, if you just watch and wait, about two-thirds of them get better on their own with just some pain medicine. And if they're not better in 3 days is when they really should start getting an antibiotic. The other category would be children 2 years and older who have a double ear infection. Even those kids, if it's not severe, get better on their own in the research studies. A double ear infection under 2 years of age is different. They get more benefit from the antibiotic. So if we stick to those non-severe infections in the kids who have a one-sided infection or a 2 years and older and have a double ear infection, about two-thirds of those get better with a watch and wait, and that saves a lot of antibiotics, not just for the child but for society.
Well, so what are the downsides of overuse of antibiotics?
There's the obvious ones. The children can get rashes. They can get upset stomachs, vomiting, nausea, diarrhea, allergic reactions, which can occasionally be serious. But the more important are the not-so-obvious ones. At the level of the child, every time you fill your body with an antibiotic, you create tremendous resistance. You select out the very tough, resistant germs that can survive that antibiotic. The next time you get sick, those are the germs you have to fight, and it can be much harder to cure the ear infection or another infection. And then, of course, at a societal level, all those tough germs now get spread around. They get spread around in daycare and preschool and other settings where there's close contact. So it's a big issue to use antibiotics excessively.
Well, Dr. Rosenfeld, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recently issued new guidelines on how to treat ear infections. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more. Dr. Richard Rosenfeld is a professor and the chairman of the otolaryngology at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center. Coming up, rare diseases from one of the most common to the rarest. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and it's 40 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect some rain today, and then rain mixing with snow tonight, a low of 29 degrees. Some snow showers are likely on Thursday, less than half an inch of accumulation, and a high of 36 degrees. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And support comes from the state auto insurance companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 25 million people in the United States suffer a rare disease of one stripe or another for which there is little research, let alone treatment. Often parents and a few dedicated doctors and researchers plow ahead despite the odds. Joining us on the eve of International Rare Disease Day from Connecticut is Mary Dunkel. She's the Vice President for Communications for the National Organization for Rare Diseases based in Danbury, Connecticut. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you, Anne.
The European Organization for Rare Diseases called the rare disease patient the orphan of the health system because without diagnosis, without treatment, without research, there often is very little hope. And that's pretty sad way to describe it, but accurate?
It is unfortunately accurate, and the word orphan is applied quite a bit to people with rare diseases because in addition to the other problems that they have, like difficulty getting a diagnosis, too little research, too few treatments, there's just a general sense of isolation and of having been forgotten.
Now, a lot changed about 30 years ago with the Orphan Drug Act, if for no other reason than it brought people together. What did the Orphan Drug Act do? It was about January 30 years ago in January.
It was, exactly. So this year is the 30th anniversary of the Orphan Drug Act, and it's also the 30th anniversary of my organization, NORD, because NORD was founded by patient advocates who had worked together to get that legislation passed by Congress and signed by President Reagan. The Orphan Drug Act provides financial incentives to encourage companies and really to make it possible for pharmaceutical companies to develop treatments for these very small patient populations. It's very expensive to go through the research process and bring a new drug to market, and it just wouldn't be happening without these incentives. So the incentives are things like 7 years of marketing exclusivity, a tax break, opportunities to meet with FDA during the process and get guidance from them and that sort of thing. And that really is what makes it possible for companies to develop these treatments.
Can you give me any examples of when it has been successful, when a company's been able to do this because of the Orphan Drug Act and they've brought out a treatment that's been successful and helped people?
Yes, and there are some wonderful examples. And I'll just preface this by saying that in the 10 years before the Orphan Drug Act, there were only 10 products developed by industry for diseases that would be considered rare today. And rare, by the way, is defined as affecting fewer than 200,000 Americans. That's the definition that our federal government uses, and that's what NORD and all of our members use also. But since 1983, since the Orphan Drug Act was enacted, there have been, I believe, 420 or so. It's over 410 products that are approved to date. And there are hundreds more in the research pipeline. And several of these are for extremely rare diseases, like maybe even diseases that only affect a few dozen people in the U.S. And if it weren't for the Orphan Drug Act, people with those diseases, and rare diseases tend to be very serious, they tend to be lifelong, and about two-thirds of the patients are children. So it's really a very serious situation, and those people wouldn't be getting any treatments at all without that legislation.
Are there any rare diseases that we're more familiar with than others because someone famous has taken up the, you know, up the shield
yeah.
for him? Like Jack Klugman, whose brother was dying of a rare disease. He's sort of one of the people that helped get the Orphan Drug Act through 30 years ago. Are there any diseases out there like that that, oh, yeah, I've heard of that disease, when actually it's actually as rare as the next rare disease, but what better known?
There are. And, you know, it's really, it's kind of very sad, actually, that a lot of times we'll get calls from parents who have a child with a very rare disease, and typically they find us at the time of diagnosis. Maybe a pediatrician or a genetic counselor will tell them about our organization, and they'll call to find out about resources. But a lot of times in those first conversations, they'll say something like, you know, I wouldn't wish this on anyone, but if somebody has to have this disease, I wish a celebrity or a celebrity's child could get it just to help. But, for instance, probably the ultimate example of the disease that people have heard of now is the disease ALS, which is also called Lou Gehrig's disease.
Okay, that's still a rare disease.
It is rare,
wow.
Yes. It's actually quite rare. Another one that comes to mind is Rett syndrome, R-E-T-T. We find that when we go out and speak now, a lot of people will ask questions about that one, and I think it's because the actress Julia Roberts, a few years ago did a TV special about a child with that syndrome. And actually, you're calling from Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio?
Yes, we work with disease-specific rare disease organizations, and there's an organization based in Ohio for a very rare condition that's actually similar to Rett syndrome in some ways and may even be related. But because a TV show was done about Rett syndrome, a lot of people have heard about that. But the other disease is called CDKL5. And probably none of your listeners have
heard of that one.
Right.
Joining us now is Margie Fraser. She's executive director of Batten Disease Support and Research Association, which is also based right here in Central Ohio. Welcome to the show, Margie.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
And by the way, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is Wellness Wednesday, and we're talking about rare diseases today. If you have a question or comment for our guests, Mary Dunkel of the National Organization for Rare Diseases or Margie Fraser of the Batten Disease Support and Research Association, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So let's talk about Batten's disease. What is Batten's disease, and how many people have it?
Well, Batten disease is considered an ultra-rare disease. At any one time in the United States, we have about 600 families who are affected. Batten disease is really a family of diseases called the neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis. There are four major types of it: an infantile form, a late infantile form, a juvenile form, and then we have an adult form. The symptoms are very similar. They just happen at
it
different ages.
It depends on when they
exactly.
manifest, right?
Typically, a disease of childhood. It's the most common neurodegenerative disease of childhood. Typically, our children start to exhibit problems at 3 or 4, clumsiness, seizures. Milestones go downward for our children. They start to have breathing problems and other organ functions ultimately end in death at 10 to 12 for the late infantile form. For the juvenile form, the symptoms start a little later, 5 to 10. Sometimes these children are diagnosed with autism because they have behavioral problems at school.
Mm-hmm.
The odyssey for diagnosis is long, unfortunately, as Mary said. families can be wandering around from doctor to doctor
because
for a long
rare.
Time. It's rare.
It's rare. Right.
Absolutely. And so when we think about awareness, one of the things we're thinking about is let's make physicians aware. And that's one of the things that we've been working on very hard in the last year, especially with pediatric neurologists.
Now, Batten Disease Support and Research Association and the Beyond Batten Disease Foundation this week
yes.
announced grants totaling nearly $1 million for research to develop treatments and a cure for Batten disease. The National Institutes of Health every year invests more than nearly $40 billion in medical research. $1 million seems like such a drop in the bucket. Mary Dunkel, is that kind of typical for a rare disease organization like this?
Well, yeah, and you know, I think it's really an important point that organizations like the one that Margie represents really do play a very important role in raising funds for research, and in many cases, those will be the only research grants for a rare disease. NORD has a research program for individuals or smaller organizations who, unlike Margie's group, don't have the capability of doing their own research grants. And a lot of times, you know, the patients and their families and their friends really become advocates and fundraisers. And I'm thinking of one family in particular that has a teenage daughter with a disease so rare that only about 200 people in the U.S. have been diagnosed with this. And that particular family has raised over $200,000 mm-hmm. for research.
It's common.
And funded three studies to date through NORD's program. Mm-hmm. These are small seed money grants, but, you know, at least they give the families hope that mm-hmm. if a study goes well, it may lead to a larger study with government funding or industry funding down the road.
So a lot of
and
the people
that's
you
very
work
important.
Margie, a lot of people you work with are family members.
Absolutely. And the press release that you're referring to is really a collaborative of these family foundations who've come together using an RFP process that our organization put together so that we could fund the very best research with our $1 million. I'd like to tell you that organizations like ours are funding millions of dollars all the time, but they are just not. What we have done is actually exceptional in the rare disease world. These seed monies that Mary talks about are very important. We are able to encourage people at the beginning of their careers or their research careers with postdoctoral fellowships and that kind of thing to interest them in the world of Batten. It's another way we raise awareness in the research community because, you know, researchers have a variety of diseases they can research, and we try to get them engaged in our work.
How often are the constituents of one disease-fighting group aligned with another rare disease group or even more common disease-fighting organization, for instance, because of a common denominator? So there's something that links them, and maybe they can piggyback onto some research being done for something that's better funded?
Exactly. And, you know, that's a very good point. There are strategies for getting drugs into bodies through the blood-brain barrier that may be important for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or other rare diseases, some not so rare. There are enzyme treatments that we're developing that might be important for other lysosomal diseases, that NCL is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so these kinds of strategies, these kinds of research attempts can be very important in other disease concepts.
Heather in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Heather.
Hi, my name is Heather. I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and I am an immune deficient patient, and I have a wonderful rare disease called X-linked lymphoproliferative disease.
Just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it?
I was diagnosed when I was 17. Unfortunately, it was about 8 years after I had mono, which triggered my disease, and my pediatrician for many, many years just kept saying, she's not a sick kid. You know, send her home, put her on some antibiotics, she'll be fine.
Good old antibiotics, yeah.
So finally, a different doctor happened to be in the office one day and noticed I had no IgAs, no IgGs, and barely any IgMs. Sent me to a wonderful doctor he had studied under, and within 2 weeks, I was already on treatment.
So I think that Heather brings up a good question for those people out there that are going for years looking for diagnosis. Mary Dunkel, what do you recommend? What works for people in terms of a strategy when you still don't even know if you have a rare disease or not? You don't know what it is.
Right, exactly. And I'll just preface this by saying that Margie said something a minute ago about her organization's growing interest and involvement in connecting with physicians and educating physicians about their disease. And I think that's something NORD's trying to do, too, just in general regarding rare diseases. There are 7,000 of these diseases, so, you know, it's just not possible for a family physician or a pediatrician to have all of them top of mind with every patient. But that said, we encourage people to, you know, be really methodical in terms of make notes. You know, don't be afraid to carry your little list or using trusted internet sources. You know, it's fine to print out things that you want to take into your physician and just say, you know, might this be me? And I preface that by saying using trusted sources, a really good teaching hospital website or a medical school website or certainly the National Institutes of Health. And family members, you know, when the patient is not able to advocate for him or herself, family members can keep lists, write down anything that seems like it might be significant. Sometimes these diseases cover a number of body systems, and so, you know, even something that may seem totally unrelated might be significant. And the most important thing of all, have a physician that you feel is willing to take the time to really listen to you and sit down and talk to you and has the curiosity to take it seriously and really wants to help you get to the bottom of what the problem is.
Thank you, Heather, for that call. We appreciate it. Chanel, we're running out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Welcome, Chanel.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Chanel. I'm from Columbus. Heather kind of asked my question, but to build on that, how do you get your family to help support you when you have a chronic undiagnosed illness and you're just kind of like, oh, she's always sick. Oh, we've got to take her to the hospital. But there's no, like, support when you're sick to help you get to the doctors and help to document what you're going through.
You know, it's actually a problem that we hear fairly frequently. And my heart goes out to people in that situation because I think there is a tendency, if something drags on for a while and a doctor can't really find anything wrong, I think sometimes there's a tendency for people, even people who love you, to kind of tune out and think, oh, you know, it's in her head. She's always sick, as you said. So, you know, I guess in those cases, it's important not to give up, to believe in yourself and, you know, to do your own research the best that you can and just keep notes and keep providing that information to people.
I agree, Mary. And Chanel, I'm sorry for what you're going through. I would also recommend reaching out to other resources. It sounds like what you're going through is very stressful and very lonely. And I always encourage our families to find a counselor. Find a social worker. Find someone that they can talk about their frustration and their fear and their isolation with. I think it's important for your mental health, and it'll help you in the long run as you continue this rare disease odyssey. And the other thing I would highly recommend is social workers in hospitals, for example, are very, very skilled at helping find resources for you in your community, including transportation, medications, and social support. And I don't be afraid to reach out. There are people who are interested in you, and it may not be your family at first.
Chanel, thanks for being such a good sister, and thanks for your call. Also, Mary Dunkel, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it today.
Thank you for having me.
Mary Dunkel is the Vice President for Communications at the National Organization for Rare Diseases, and Marcy Frazier right here in Columbus, actually Grandview Heights.
Grandview Heights.
Executive Director of the Batten Disease Support and Research Association. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And when we return, we're going to hear from an emergency room physician in Columbus about heart disease and new research breakthroughs on heart disease. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
As speculation swirls about why Pope Benedict XVI chose to resign, the church is dealing with the child sex abuse scandal, a money laundering probe involving the Vatican Bank, and reports of financial and sexual misconduct among church officials. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Vatican correspondent John Favis. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And watch WOSU-TV Friday night for a new show celebrating the musical legacy of Pink Floyd. This special, Brit Floyd, live in Liverpool, includes classic hits such as Learning to Fly, Wish You Were Here, Comfortably Numb, and many more. It's Brit Floyd, live in Liverpool, and it's Friday night at 9 on WOSU-TV. 40 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect some rain showers for today, mixing with some snow, and snow showers mainly for tonight, a low of 29 degrees. Some snow likely on Thursday as well, less than half an inch of accumulation, a high of 36. Program support comes from the College of Arts and Sciences, where Mozart's powerful Requiem will be staged with 252 vocalists and 35 orchestral musicians at 3 p.m. on Sunday, March 3rd in Mershon Auditorium. More details at music.osu.edu. And support comes from Ohio State's Department of Neurology, conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can improve the outcome of traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study, including a community opinion survey and how to opt out of the study, are at protectiii.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. When you hear about someone having a heart attack, what's the first thing you think about? In the 2003 hit movie Something's Gotta Give, Diane Keaton's character knew what she was talking about when her co-star Jack Nicholson was down for the count.
I don't know what happened. Since we were fooling around, and then he just said he felt funny, and then he just collapsed.
Harry, what is it?
I'm okay, fine.
Does your chest hurt?
It's like an elephant.
Call 911. Tell them to send an ambulance. Mary, now!
Sure enough, in the movie and in real life, the ER doc is there to pick up the pieces. But our guest today, herself an emergency room physician, has some news about heart health to help you avoid that trip to the ER in the first place. Dr. Diane Gorgas is an associate professor of emergency medicine and the residency director of the EM training program at OSU's Wexner Medical Center. She writes about her experiences as an emergency room physician in a monthly column for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thanks for having me, Ann. I just love your show, and I'm honored to be here.
Thank you. In the movie Something's Gotta Give, which we have established you have not seen.
Correct.
Diane Keaton's character also gives CPR to the Nicholson character, but I couldn't use that clip because there's a naughty word in it. But there is a new study that found that CPR does make a difference.
And it makes a difference how long CPR is given as well. We used to think that the brain was relatively intolerant of anoxia, or a low oxygen state and a low flow state. But we're finding that CPR is more effective than we have ever thought it to be in the past. This particular study, which was published in The Lancet, looked at the survival rates of patients who had undergone CPR for 16, which is pretty much standard, 16 minutes versus a prolonged CPR of 25 minutes, and found that the patients that had undergone CPR for longer periods of time, upwards of a half an hour, actually did well. Their risk of sudden cardiac death and then surviving from that was, their survival rate was actually 12% greater than those undergoing the shorter term of CPR. And it didn't impart a significantly negative neurologic score to those patients. In other words, they recovered and were neurologically intact just as much as the patients who had undergone CPR for a shorter amount of time.
Okay, and CPR is, of course, short for cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
Right.
And when we're talking about CPR in this context, are we talking about something that anybody could do if they knew how to do it?
Anybody can do CPR if they know how to do it. And the American Heart Association over the last 2 to 3 years has really looked at the research and come up with some revised recommendations for CPR. The one thing that has made people hesitate in jumping in with bystander CPR is the mouth-to-mouth or the rescue breathing component
of it. Which is where the naughty word came into the scene there, but go on.
So the new recommendations of the American Heart Association that are slowly rolling out currently look at compression-only CPR and eliminate the mouth-to-mouth component of it completely, which I think will make huge strides in the number of bystanders willing to do CPR on a collapsed patient.
So what do we know about CPR? It's the duration, but couldn't it be the duration of the mouth-to-mouth, in other words, getting the oxygen to the brain and that sort of thing, or what?
Well, what we're finding is that the whole pathophysiology or the mechanism of brain injury when the brain is starved of oxygen is much more complex than we thought. It's not just keeping oxygen flowing to the brain so it can function normally. We actually kind of want the brain to go into a quieter or a hibernation type of state. It's led to some other advances in post-resuscitation care, including the fact that it's almost standard now that a patient post-cardiac arrest will undergo hypothermia therapy to really decrease the metabolic drive and the metabolic function of the brain. And that preserves a lot of neurologic function. So it's not only getting oxygen to the brain, it's getting oxygen to the brain at the right time when the brain is prepared for it. And that's why these early studies looking at compression-only CPR have shown that the survival rates with that actually increase.
So that's all of that said. What are your recommendations if someone thinks they might be having a heart attack, or what are the signs for women and men that you say get to the emergency room ASAP? I wanted to say ASAP, but
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. The signs are chest pain. It can be chest pain associated with shortness of breath, associated with nausea and vomiting.
Meaning when you're trying to take a breath, it hurts to try to take a breath.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It is very difficult for physicians to determine if chest pain is related to a heart attack, a decreased circulation to the heart, or a cause that is completely separate from a cardiac cause. We don't ask our patients to be able to make that determination.
Mm-hmm.
We want them to get to us so that we can run an EKG, that we can do some other testing, and we can figure out if it's their heart or not, either get them home back to a normal, healthy, productive life, or intervene and get therapy if it is their heart.
If you are just joining us, my guest is Diane Gorgas. She's a doctor. She is an emergency room doctor at the Wexner Center, and she is also a residency director of the EM training program and a regular columnist for the Dispatch, if you maybe recognize the name. We're talking about heart-related disease and some breakthroughs over the past year. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Gorgas, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So we're now on the verge of being able to grow new tissues to help with disease. And there's one, myogenesis is the name for the process of growing new heart muscle. And the question has been, how do you get it beating? How do you get it animated? That's incredible. That's Frankensteinian, sort of.
It is Frankensteinian. This is cutting-edge medicine that we're talking about. The idea of transplantation really goes back to the 60s and maybe even a little bit before, but it's always been macroscopic transplantation. It's always been transplantation of whole organs. We're now to the point where we can look at transplantation of special cells that do the function that's particularly missing. So let's look at the heart, for example. In heart failure, the heart is still beating, but with much less power and much less effectiveness than a normal heart. That's because a number of the cells within the heart that are responsible for beating, the cardiomyocytes themselves, are either damaged or were never working in the first place in the situation of like congenital heart disease. There are a number of studies out within this last year, two of them in Nature that actually looked at reprogramming some of the structural cells that normally aren't the beating cells within the heart, but using gene therapy to turn on those cells' capacity to become beating cells. So to augment the kind of crippled portion of the heart that's trying to beat. There were two other studies in Lancet that looked at taking biopsied heart cells, putting them in a cell preparation, purifying them, and then re-injecting them into the heart so that they become functioning, beating heart cells. And the compilation of four of these studies really showed that we can essentially repair permanently damaged hearts by reimplanting these cells or turning them on.
It's so amazing to think about all of this at the cellular level, that there's beating cells and non-beating cells and that they have such specific functions.
And it really obviates the old way of thinking with transplant medicine, that you need strong immunosuppressives and you need to trick the body into it accepting an organ. When you strip functions of the body down into cellular components, you can frequently completely circumvent the immune reaction that a transplanted organ would give you. And instead, the body kind of gladly accepts these cells and the patient can go on without all the side effects of immune therapy.
Bethany in Pickerington, you're on the air with Dr. Diane Gorgas. Welcome to the show, Bethany.
Thank you very much. My question is related to children heart issues. My child is 9 and a female, and she is on some medications that have been known to have some heart-related side effects. And one of the things that I'm curious about are, you know, with adults, I know there's, you know, between men and women, there's differences to look for with, you know, if there's, you know, a heart-related issue. And they don't really emphasize with children what kind of differences to look for. You know, I'm always curious if there's something that I should be aware of, you know, that would be different with her if she were, you know, experiencing some type of cardiac, you know, emergency.
It's an interesting question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And most of the differences in the way that women and men present with heart disease and heart-related symptoms are hormonally related. Now, if you speculate that and take it to a pediatric population, you might say that those hormonal changes aren't as prominent between girls and boys as they are between men and women. So I would think that the presentation between boys and girls would be more similar than it would be into adult life.
Okay.
But it's a great question to ask your doctor as well, specifically looking at your child's disease process and how that might present differently.
Okay.
Thanks, Bethany.
Great. Thank you so much.
There's another prospect out there for improving heart health, and it's by using the patient's own heart cells. Is that what you were talking about, the purification
right.
from Lancet?
Okay. Exactly. There
so
were two
it's their
articles.
Own
in,
cells. Okay.
Right. They can actually biopsy the patient's heart cells, a portion of the heart itself that a biopsy doesn't puncture all the way into the heart. It doesn't negatively impact the beating or the functioning of the heart. But a small sample of those cells can be taken to the lab. They can be purified and they can be duplicated or they can be grown and then reimplanted into that heart to really increase the pumping potential of an already damaged heart.
Okay, this was really interesting to me when I was looking at the top 10 things for 2012 regarding the heart, that kidneys might be the culprits in some people with high blood pressure, that it's not heart-related, it's kidney-related.
Yeah.
What's that about?
So A lot of our blood pressure control is hormonally regulated through the kidneys. The sympathetic center, or the center that tells us how fast our heart should be pumping, how high our blood pressure should be, that actually sits within the kidneys and the adrenal gland itself. We know that some patients respond very well to pharmacologic therapy, to medications for their high blood pressure, but there have always been that subset of patients that no matter how many different agents we use or the combination of agents, that their blood pressure remains poorly controlled. This study, which was done in a journal called Hypertension, looked at the potential of going in with a catheter and ablating, or essentially disabling, the sympathetic center that's located within the kidney just with radio waves. It's the same way that we can ablate abnormal portions of the heart if there's a dysrhythmia, but we're doing it to the kidney here. So it's
like with a pacemaker thing? Or?
Almost like with a pacemaker.
Okay.
It's catheter-derived, so one little puncture in the groin, they thread a catheter up to the kidney. They place this radio frequency probe right next to the area of the kidney that is hyperactive or in overdrive and causing the hypertension and the high heart rate. And they can actually burn that area of the kidney out so that it doesn't stimulate the blood pressure to rise uncontrollably. And it's actually found that these patients still have normal kidney function after we do this. Their blood pressures are remarkably well controlled afterwards, and it's one of the biggest risk factors for heart disease, so it represents a real advancement in decreasing the risk of heart disease.
And it's a relatively simple procedure.
And it is a relatively non-invasive procedure. No surgery, just a catheter that does this.
What about the diagnostic side of it? Is it easy to diagnose?
Hypertension in and of itself is easy
yes,
to diagnose.
Right.
The cause of it being in the kidney and the selection of patients to who will respond well to this therapy, this intervention therapy, really comes from a history of failure on multiple medications.
Okay.
Medications are still first-line therapy for high blood pressure, and most people do respond to medications. This therapy is really derived for those patients who are resistant to standard therapy.
You know, we're always hearing now about, and I want to do a whole show about biological markers now that they're
right.
discovering for people. Would that be something that that the medical, or the researchers would be looking for when it comes to something like this? Is there a biological marker out there? Is there something else that would suggest the kidney relationship?
Let me tell you, Anne, if there's not a biological marker today, there will be a biological marker tomorrow.
Yeah.
It is amazing how specific biological markers are getting. Biological markers can tell you if you're a patient with heart disease, if you're going to respond to aspirin, or if you're going to respond to another antiplatelet agent. They can tell you if your hypertension is going to respond to medication A, medication B, medication C, or a combination of all of the above. And someday we're going to have markers that tell us who not to even bother starting on medication, who to do this denervating procedure on initially. We're not quite there yet, but we're going to get there, and it's going to happen soon.
It's pretty exciting.
Yeah,
pretty exciting stuff. Diane Gorgas, thanks so much for joining us today. I hope to come back.
Thanks so much. I hope you have me.
Dr. Diane Gorgas is an associate professor of emergency medicine at the Wexner Medical Center. She's a residency director of the EM training program there and a regular columnist for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks to the Allside staff for this Wellness Wednesday. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler, Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.